Geekscape.com.
Hello, and welcome to Aryan Narrations. You're listening to me, Sven Longshanks, and today's narration is taken from The History of the Kings of Britain by Geoffrey of Monmouth. And this is the second one in the series, and it's entitled Diana Prophesies to Brutus. Meanwhile, the Trojans sailed on for 2 days and one night, with a favourable wind blowing. Then they touched land at a certain island called Leagetia, which had remained uninhabited since it was laid waste by a piratical attack in ancient times. Brutus landed 300 armed men on the island to see if anything at all lived there. They found no one, but they killed all sorts of wild animals which they had discovered between the forest pastures and the woodlands. They came to a deserted city, and there they found a temple of Diana. In the city there was a statue of the goddess, which gave answers if by chance it was questioned by anyone. In the end, they returned to their ships, loaded with the game which they had discovered, and described the city and the lie of the land to their comrades. They suggested to their leader that he should go to the temple, and that, when he had offered sacrifices, he should inquire of the deity of the place what land she would grant them as a safe and permanent dwelling place. By the common consent of all, Brutus took with him the Augur Gero and 12 of the older men, and set out for the temple, carrying everything necessary for a sacrifice. When they reached the place, they wrapped fillets around their brows, and, according to the age-old rite, they set up 3 sacrificial hearths to the 3 gods, to Jupiter, that is, to Mercury, and to Diana. To each in turn they poured a libation. Brutus stood before the altar of the goddess, holding in his right hand a vessel full of sacrificial wine mixed with the blood of a white hind, and with his face upturned towards the statue of the godhead, he broke the silence with these words. O powerful goddess, terror of the forest glades, yet hope of the wild woodlands, you who have the power to go in orbit through the airy heavens and the halls of hell, pronounce a judgment which concerns the earth. Tell me which lands you wish us to inhabit. Tell me of a safe dwelling place where I am to worship you down the ages, and where, to the chanting of maidens, I shall dedicate temples to you. This he said 9 times. 4 times he proceeded around the altar, pouring the wine which he held upon the sacrificial hearth. Then he lay down upon the skin of a hind which he had stretched before the altar. Having sought for slumber, he at length fell asleep. It was then about the 3rd hour of the night when mortal beings succumb to the sweetest rest. It seemed to him that the goddess stood before him and spoke these words to him. Brutus, beyond the setting of the sun, past the realms of Gaul, there lies an island in the sea, once occupied by giants. Now it is empty and ready for your folk. Down the years this will prove an abode suited to you, and to your people, and for your descendants it will be a second Troy. A race of kings will be born there, from your stock, and the round circle of the whole earth will be subject to them. When he awoke from his vision, the leader remained in doubt as to whether it had been a dream which he had experienced, or whether the living goddess really had prophesied the land to which he should travel. In the end, he called his comrades together and told them in full detail what had happened to him in his sleep. They were delighted, and advised him to turn back to the ships, and to travel westwards under full sail in search of what the goddess had promised them, while the wind still blew fair. Without wasting time, they turned back to their friends and put to sea. After ploughing through the waves in a crossing which lasted 30 days, they arrived in Africa, still not knowing in which direction they should steer their ships. Then they came to the altars of the Philistines, and to the Salt Pan Lake, and from there they sailed on between Rusicada and the mountains of Zarek. In this spot they suffered great danger from an attack by pirates, but they beat it off, and became the richer by booty and plunder. After this, they passed the river Malve and landed in Mauritania. There they were harassed by lack of food and drink. They therefore disembarked from their ships, split up into groups, and ravaged the country from end to end. Once they had re-victualled, they sailed for the Pillars of Hercules, and there those deep-sea monsters called the Sirens made their appearance and nearly sank their ships as they moved forward. They escaped, however, and came upon four generations born to exiles from Troy, generations which had accompanied Antenor in his flight. Their leader was called Corineus, a sober-minded man, wise in counsel, yet of great courage and audacity. If he were to come up against a giant, he would overthrow him as easily as if he were fighting against a mere boy. As soon as they had realized that his stock was of such high antiquity, they took him into alliance with them straight away, together with the people over whom he ruled. Later, Cornwall was called after the name of this leader. In every battle, he was of more help to Brutus than anyone else. Next, they came to Aquitaine, where they entered the estuary of the Loire and cast anchor. They remained there for 7 days and explored the lie of the land. At this time, Goffar the Pict ruled in Aquitaine and was king of that country. When he learned that a foreign people with a huge fleet had landed within the confines of his kingdom, he sent messengers to them to ask whether they brought peace or war. While the messengers were still on their way to the fleet, they met Corineus, who had just landed with 200 men to hunt for game under the woodland trees. The messengers immediately accosted him and asked by whose permission he had entered the king's forest to kill his animals, seeing that it had been decreed from ancient times that no one should hunt there without the ruler's order. Corineus answered them that permission was completely unnecessary. Then one of their number called Himbert rushed forward, drew his bow and aimed an arrow at him. Corineus dodged the arrow, charged at Himbert, and broke his head in pieces with the bow which he was carrying. Thereupon the others fled, escaping with some difficulty from the hands of Corineus, and reported the death of their comrade to Goffar. The leader of the Poitevins, who was saddened by the news, collected a huge army together so that he could take vengeance on them for the death of his messenger. When Brutus heard of Goffar's coming, he put his ships in a state of defence, ordering all the women and children to remain on board, and then set out himself to meet the enemy, with his entire force of vigorous young men. The battle began, and the fighting was fierce on both sides. When they had spent a great part of the day in slaughtering each other, Corineus felt ashamed that the Aquitanians should be so steadfast in their resistance, and that the Trojans should not be able to press on to victory. He took fresh heart, called his own men over to the right of the battle, arranged them in fighting formation, and charged headlong at the enemy. With his troops in close order, he broke through their ranks in front and went on killing the enemy until he had worked right through their force and compelled them all to flee. He lost his sword, but by good luck he had a battle axe, and anything he struck with this he cut in two, from top to bottom. Brutus was greatly impressed by his boldness and courage. So were his comrades, and so indeed were the enemy. Corineus brandished his battle axe among the retreating battalions, and added not a little to their terror by shouting, "Where are you making for, you cowards? Where are you running to, you slackers? Turn back! Turn back, I say, and do battle with Corineus. Shame on you. You are so many thousands, and yet you run away from me, who am one. Take at least this comfort in your flight, that it is I, Corineus, who am after you. I, who often drive in confusion before me the giants of Etruria, thrusting them down to hell, three or four at a time." At these words of his, one of the Poitavan leaders, called Suhard, did turn back and charged at him with 300 fighting men. Corineus received on his outstretched shield the blow which Suhard dealt him. Then he remembered the battle axe which he was holding. He swung it up in the air, struck Suhard on the crest of his helmet, and at the spot where he made contact, split him in two halves from top to bottom. Then he rushed at the others, twirling his battle axe, and went on causing the same destruction. Up and down he ran, avoiding none of the blows which were dealt him, and never pausing in his destruction of the enemy. From one he severed an arm and a hand. From another he carved the very shoulders from his body. At a single blow he struck off one man's head, while from another he cut away the legs. He was the one whom they all attacked, and he, in his turn, took them all on. Brutus was filled with emotion when he saw this, and he hurried forward with one of his companies to bring assistance to Corineus. A great bellow of shouting arose between the two peoples. Many blows were struck, and terrible slaughter was inflicted on each side. This could not go on much longer. The Trojans were victorious. They drove King Gophar and his Poitavans backwards in flight. Gophar managed to get away. He fled to the other regions of Gaul to seek help from his kinsmen and friends. At that time, there were in Gaul 12 kings of equal rank, under whose dominion the whole country was ruled. They received Gophar sympathetically, and promised with one accord that they would drive this foreign people out of the lands of Aquitaine. Brutus was overjoyed at this victory. He enriched his comrades with the spoils of those whom they had killed, marshalled them once more into companies, and then marched through the country in this order, for it was his intention to sack it completely, and to load his ships with all its goods. He therefore burned the cities, far and wide, heaping up fire upon fire. He carried away the goods which he had looted in these cities, and he even ravaged the open fields. He wrought pitiable slaughter on both townsfolk and peasantry, for his plan was to exterminate this unhappy race, down to the last man. However, when Brutus had inflicted this devastation upon almost all the regions of Aquitaine, he came to the place which is now called Tours, the city which, as Homer testifies, he himself afterwards founded. When he was examining places suitable for a refuge, it was here that he measured out a camp into which he might retreat if need should arise. He was driven to this by the fear caused by the arrival of Gophar, who had marched through this same neighbourhood with the kings and princes of Gaul and a huge force of armed men so that he might do battle with Brutus. When his own camp was completely finished, Brutus waited there 2 days for Gophar, relying on his own prudence and the courage of the young men whom he had under command. When Gophar learned of the presence of the Trojans in this neighbourhood, he advanced by forced marches through the day and the night until he came close enough to see the camp of Brutus. He gazed at it grimly, and then, with a sardonic smile, burst forth with these words: "How sad my destiny is! These ignoble exiles have pitched their camp in my kingdom. Arm yourselves, men, arm yourselves, and charge through their serried ranks. In a short time we shall seize hold of these weaklings as if they were sheep, and carry them captive through our kingdom." All the men whom he had brought with him immediately armed themselves, and marched, drawn up as they were, in 12 columns, towards the enemy. The reaction of Brutus to this was far from that of a weakling. He placed his companies in position, and prudently instructed his troops as to what they were to do. When they joined battle, the Trojans, at first, had the upper hand, and inflicted fearful slaughter on the enemy. Some 2,000 of the Gauls fell dead, and in their terror, the remainder were on the point of running away. But victory has the habit of appearing on the side where the number of men is the greater. Thus, although they had been driven back at first, the Gauls later on reformed and attacked the Trojans on all sides, for they were 3 times as numerous as the others. The Gauls caused great slaughter among the Trojans and forced them to withdraw into their camp. When this victory was won, the Gauls besieged the Trojans in their camp, firm in the conviction that they themselves would never withdraw until the enemy, whom they had surrounded, had either offered their necks to be encircled with chains or had been cruelly tortured to death after suffering for a long time from hunger. Meanwhile, on the next evening, Corineus had a conference with Brutus, saying that he wanted to make his way out that same night along certain little-known trackways and conceal himself until daybreak in a neighbouring wood. Brutus should leave the camp at first light, and while he was engaging the enemy, Corineus should attack from the rear, and by charging at them, bring about the overthrow of the Gauls. This plan of Corineus was approved by Brutus. Corineus emerged with all caution, as he had proposed, accompanied by 3,000 men, and made his way into the depths of the woods. When the next day dawned, Brutus arranged his troops in battalions, opened up the gates of the camp, and marched forth to battle. The Gauls immediately attacked him. They drew up their own line of battle and fought with Brutus hand to hand. Each side inflicted wounds on the other, and in both of the two armies, many thousands of men immediately fell dead, for no one spared his opponent. A certain Trojan called Turnus, who was a nephew of Brutus, was there, and apart from Corineus, no one was stronger or bolder than he. He slew 600 men himself with his own sword, but he was killed before his time by the Gauls, who made a sudden attack upon him. The city of Tours, which we have already mentioned, took its name from Turnus, for he was buried there. While the troops on either side were fighting bitterly, Corineus unexpectedly attacked the enemy from the rear, coming at full speed. Thereupon, the other Trojans pressed on with all the more courage and renewed the attack from the front in their effort to complete the slaughter. The Gauls were terrified as much as anything by the din raised by Corineus as he charged them from their rear, for they thought that more men had come than were really there. They left the field at full speed, and the Trojans pursued them with their blows. In their pursuit, the Trojans continued to slaughter the Gauls, and they did not abandon the bloodshed until they had gained victory. Although this signal triumph brought him great joy, Brutus was nevertheless filled with anxiety, for the number of his men became smaller every day, while that of the Gauls was constantly increasing. Brutus was in doubt as to whether he could oppose the Gauls any longer, and he finally chose to return to his ships in the full glory of his victory, while the greater part of his comrades were still safe, and then to seek out the island which divine prophecy had promised would be his. Nothing else was done. With the approval of his men, Brutus returned to his fleet. He loaded his ships with all the riches which he had acquired, and then went on board. So, with the winds behind him, he sought the promised island, and came ashore at Totnes. At this time, the island of Britain was called Albion. It was uninhabited except for a few giants. It was, however, most attractive because of the delightful situation of its various regions, its forests, and the great number of its rivers, which teemed with fish, and it filled Brutus and his comrades with a great desire to live there. When they had explored the different districts, they drove the giants, whom they had discovered, into the caves in the mountains. With the approval of their leader, they divided the land among themselves. They began to cultivate the fields and to build houses, so that in a short time you would have thought that the land had always been inhabited. Brutus then called the island Britain, from his own name, and his companions he called Britons. His intention was that his memory should be perpetuated by the derivation of the name. A little later, the language of the people, which had up to then been known as Trojan or Crooked Greek, was called British for the same reason. Corineus, however, following in this the example of his leader, called the region of the kingdom which had fallen to his share Cornwall, after the manner of his own name, and the people who lived there he called Cornishmen. Although he might have chosen his own estates before all the others who had come there, he preferred the region which is now called Cornwall, either for its being the Cornu, or Horn of Britain, or through a corruption of his own name. Corineus experienced great pleasure from wrestling with the giants, of whom there were far more there than in any of the districts which had been distributed among his comrades. Among the others there was a particularly repulsive one, called Gogmagog, who was 12 feet tall. He was so strong that, once he had given it a shake, he could tear up an oak tree as though it were a hazel wand. Once, when Brutus was celebrating a day dedicated to the gods in the port where he had landed, this creature, along with 20 other giants, attacked him and killed a great number of the Britons. However, the Britons finally gathered together from round and about and overcame the giants and slew them all, except for Gogmagog. Brutus ordered that he alone should be kept alive, for he wanted to see a wrestling match between this giant and Corineus, who enjoyed beyond all reason matching himself against such monsters. Corineus was delighted by this. He girded himself, threw off his armour, and challenged Gogmagog to a wrestling match. The contest began. Corineus moved in, so did the giant. Each of them caught the other in a hold by twining his arms around him, and the air vibrated with their panting breath. Gogmagog gripped Corineus with all his might and broke 3 of his ribs, 2 on the right side and 1 on the left. Corineus then summoned all his strength, for he was infuriated by what had happened. He heaved Gogmagog up onto his shoulders, and running as fast as he could, under the weight, he hurried off to the nearby coast. He clambered up to the top of a mighty cliff, shook himself free, and hurled this deadly monster, whom he was carrying on his shoulders, far out into the sea. The giant fell onto a sharp reef of rocks, where he was dashed into 1,000 fragments and stained the waters with his blood. The place took its name from the fact that the giant was hurled down there, and it is called Gogmagog's Leap to this day. Once he had divided up his kingdom, Brutus decided to build a capital. In pursuit of this plan, he visited every part of the land in search of a suitable spot. He came at length to the River Thames, walked up and down its banks, and so chose a site suited to his purpose. There he then built his city, and called it Troynova. It was known by this name for long ages after, but finally, by a corruption of the word, it came to be called Trinovantium. After Lud, the brother of Cassivellaunus, who fought with Julius Caesar, had seized command of the government of the kingdom, he surrounded the city with lofty walls and with towers built with extraordinary skill, and he ordered it to be called Carlud, or Lud's City, from his own name. As a result, a great quarrel arose later on between him and his brother Nennius, who was annoyed that he should want to do away with the name of Troy in his own country. However, since Gildas the historian has dealt with this quarrel at sufficient length, I prefer to omit it, for I do not wish to appear to be spoiling by my homelier style what so distinguished a writer has set out with so much eloquence. When the aforementioned leader, Brutus, had built the city about which I have told you, he presented it to the citizens by right of inheritance, and gave them a code of laws by which they might live peacefully together. At that time, the priest Eli was ruling in Judea, and the Ark of the Covenant was captured by the Philistines. The sons of Hector reigned in Troy, for the descendants of Antenor had been driven out. In Italy reigned Aeneas Silvius, son of Aeneas and uncle of Brutus, the third of the Latin kings. In the meantime, Brutus had consummated his marriage with his wife Inige. By her he had 3 sons called Locrinus, Camber, and Albanactus, all of whom were to become famous. When their father finally died, in the 23rd year after his landing, these 3 sons buried him inside the walls of the town which he had founded, They divided the kingdom of Britain between them in such a way that each succeeded to Brutus in one particular district. Locrinus, who was the firstborn, inherited the part of the island which was afterwards called Logria after him. Camber received the region which is on the further bank of the River Severn, the part which is now known as Wales, but which was, for a long time after his death, called Cambria from his name. As a result, the people of that country still call themselves Cymru today in the Welsh tongue. Albanactus, the youngest, took the region which is nowadays called Scotland in our language. He called it Albany, after his own name. Eventually, when these three had reigned in peace and harmony for a long time, Humber, the king of the Huns, landed in Albany. He met Albanactus in battle, killed him, and forced the people of his country to flee to Locrinus. As soon as Locrinus heard the news, he persuaded his brother Camber to join him in an alliance. Locrinus called up all the young men of his own country and went out to meet the king of the Huns, somewhere near the river which is now called the Humber. When the two forces made contact, Locrinus forced Humber to flee. Humber retreated as far as the river and was then drowned beneath its waters, giving his name to the stream. Once he had gained this victory, Locrinus distributed the spoils of the enemy among his allies, keeping back nothing for himself except the gold and silver, which he found on board their ships. He also reserved for himself three young women of striking beauty. The first of these girls was the daughter of the King of Germany. Humber had seized this girl, along with the other two, at a time when he was sacking her homeland. Her name was Estrildis, and she was of such beauty that it would be difficult to find a young woman worthy to be compared with her. No precious ivory, no recently fallen snow, no lilies even, could surpass the whiteness of her skin. Locrinus was overcome with passion for her. He was determined to make love with her, and he even went so far as to suggest that she might marry him. When he discovered this, Corineus was greatly annoyed, for Locrinus had promised that he would marry Corineus' own daughter. Corineus therefore went to the king and addressed him as follows, brandishing his battle axe as he did so. "These, then, Locrinus, are the rewards you offer me in exchange for all the wounds which I have received through my allegiance to your father, at the time when he was waging war with unknown peoples. My daughter is to be passed over, and you are to demean yourself to the point where you will be prepared to marry some barbarian woman or other. You will not do this unpunished, as long, that is, as strength is left to this right hand of mine, which has torn the joy of living from many a giant up and down the Tyrrhenian shores." He bellowed out these words, again and again, brandishing his battle axe as if he were going to strike Locrinus. Then the friends of the two men came between them. These friends forced Locrinus to carry out what he had promised, and Corineus was pacified. Locrinus duly married Corineus' daughter, whose name was Gwendolyn. For all that, he could not forget the love which he felt for Estrildis. He had a cave dug beneath the town of Trinovantium, and there he shut Estrildis up, putting her in the care of his servants, with orders that she should be treated with all honour, for despite everything that had happened, he was determined to make love with her in secret. Locrinus was so consumed with fear of Corineus that he did not dare to entertain Estrildis openly. Therefore he concealed her, as has been explained. He visited her for 7 whole years without anyone being the wiser, except those who were the deepest in his confidence. Whenever he went to Estrildis, he gave it out that he intended to make some secret sacrifice to his gods, and he managed to persuade others to believe this, although it was not true. In the end, Estrildis became pregnant and gave birth to an extraordinarily beautiful daughter, whom she called Habren. Gwendolyn was pregnant too, and she bore a son who was given the name Madon. This Madon was handed over to his grandfather Corineus to be taught his early lessons. Some time later, When Corineus was at long last dead, Locrinus deserted Gwendolen and took Estrildis as his queen. Gwendolen was most indignant at this. She went off to Cornwall, and there she assembled all the young men of that region and began to harass Locrinus with border forays. At last, when both sides had gathered an army together, they joined battle near the River Stour. There, Locrinus was struck by an arrow, and so departed from the joys of this life. With Locrinus out of the way, Gwendolen took over the government of the kingdom, behaving in the same extravagant fashion as her father had done. She ordered Estrildis and her daughter Habren to be thrown into the river, which is now called the Severn, and she published an edict throughout the length and breadth of Britain that this river should be called after the girl's name. Gwendolen's intention was that this everlasting honour should be done to Habren, because her own husband had been the girl's father. It thus comes about that right down to our own times, this river is called Habren in the British language, although by a corruption of speech, it is called Sabrina in the other tongue.
Alternative.